Welcome to the latest Legends of Tomorrow Fleshcast. I am here, Lisa Schmeiser, non-puppet, non-cat, still human, and joining me, where on the internet no one knows if you're a puppet, a cat, or non-human, is Tony Sindelar.
Hello, nerds.
And Dan Morin.
Hello, I prefer to think of myself as a custodian of the chronology.
I knew you were going to be that one. I know who you are.
I'm consistent.
We're here to discuss the episode from Monday, December 11th, 2018, Legends of To Meow Meow, where honestly the only limit on everyone's creativity seemed to be an all cat ship. We didn't get that, but we got everything else. So
you don't want to have to pay the cat wrangler too much. It's very expensive.
Cats I listened to the
one thing I learned from the director's commentary of Inside Llewellyn Davis is that cats are horrible actors, basically.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen that movie. There's a cat in it a lot, and the Coen brothers had a lot of trouble with a cat.
So. I often wondered how Oscar Isaac kept his cool, or if there's just like an entire another.
I think the answer is that he did not.
Where it's nothing but him cursing and flinging the cat off screen.
I mean, not surprisingly, basically, the idea that you can train a cat is farcical. So
yeah, cats do what they want, man.
Yeah. So, and they don't particularly care to be in movies. So
yeah, this is the internet. All of us are familiar with cats.
Yes. At least not just movies directed by your terrible human directors.
Yeah.
Nothing with plot or intention ever happens with cats. Yeah. So what we do, since this is a feature on podcasts that I tend to run, is we have one person who does a quick recap of what happened over the course of the episode to make sure we're all on the same page. This week, the task falls to Tony.
Hello.
And I was going to say, do you want me to count you down or do you just want to start and we'll see how long it goes?
I'm ready. Whenever you say go, I'll go.
All right. Sounds good. All right. Ready? In 5, 4, 3, 2... go.
Well, the universe is all messed up. Reality is in a bad place because of John Constantine's choice to unwind time. And this episode is basically all about can we fix the timeline without actually going back and undoing the breaking of it, where we get to see many alternate versions of the legends, what do they look like if various people drop out of the legends or are killed out of the legends, I should specify. So without Sarah, they become the bro-y custodians of chronology, and we get a wonderful 80s opening sequence for that. With all the men killed off, they become the sirens of space time, Ava joins the team. I guess Gideon gets a body somehow.
Never explained.
And then, if the fairy godmother does not go to hell, she's not sent to hell by John Constantine, she will be fated to team up with Nick Rory. And one of the things he does is at her suggest that they are all puppets of the Time Bureau. So they become not just puppets, but like Saturday morning puppets. And then the fairy godmother and Mick go on a crime spree, I guess.
Yes.
Eventually, things are restored, including scenes with three different John Constantines. And ultimately, in order to restore the timeline, you've got to do the bad stuff. And there is no way to save Constantine's lover from being damned to hell. But at the very end, we discover that the demon is apparently tied... Not surprisingly, the demon is tied up with defense contractors and is a golfing buddy of Nate's father. So, yeah,
and Legends of Tomorrow. And he's also wearing the face of John Constantine's lover. So,
because if you're a demon, you're into being psychologically scarring.
And
it's just required.
And golf.
Yeah. Yes, and golf. Well,
if you introduce the handsome descendant of Marie Laveau in one episode, you have to keep bringing him back.
I will say, I knew that actor would return as he recently. So the CW is infamous for like actors who appear on multiple shows because they get these contracts. They're all in Vancouver, right? So that guy, that actor, did a stint on Supernatural last season and in a fairly significant role. I was like, that guy seems like a small. That seems like a small part to have that guy in. Mm-hmm. Oh, wait, just kidding. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed this episode. I briefly looked at some headlines and it seemed like it actually got kind of mixed reviews, but this may be the most entertaining 40 minutes that the Arrowverse has brought me ever. I was just laughing the whole way through. I thought it was ridiculous. I mean, just at the certain point when they're just like zipping into the time bureau and just checking which plaques are on the wall. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Gary
I just thought
killed as a courier to Mount Vesuvius.
I didn't even mention the scene where Gary thinks he's talking to his future self, even though there's a shapeshifter. And then they go back to, they restore time, and the killer puppet is still there, and it's like, I had forgotten about the killer puppet, because so much madness has happened in the in-between. Just the cat in the backpack, there is just, there is so much in here to be happy about.
There is too much.
Yeah.
I found it very poignant that, like, the first time Gary meets his future self, what he asks is, do I find love? I mean, just, that. It was just, I was oddly touched by that. Like, you really know that.
Yeah, his grin is just, it's when I see it now, it's just, like, you can't but feel like a little bit of joy when you see him. Lisa, did you watch the Elseworlds? He has a minor cameo in Elseworlds, which is, it's Gary, so it's enjoyable.
Yeah, it is pretty.
He's in it for about 6 seconds. So.
Yeah, in a very Gary role.
Yes. So.
Oh my goodness!
It is not. It's not. Have to start plot relevant.
Perhaps the one character in that show who actually doesn't change in an alternate universe.
Well, his career is different. But yeah,
I will have to say also, I'm looking at as I look at this. I guess there was a tweet from the writers' room suggesting other titles for this episode, which include Days of Future Cats, A Murder of Constantine's, The Super Friends, and Get Meow to Here.
Those are all great.
So. There are many, many more on this list.
Yeah, if you were a John Constantine super fan, this was your episode. Because, again, there's one point where you actually do have three Constantines, and I was really grateful that they had done tie-wearing John Constantine, and then trench coat John Constantine. Yeah. Because this allowed you to keep track of them all. What I also especially appreciated about that scene is when Rory and Ray are supposed to be shooting him, and Ray looks over and Rory has a sandwich. He's like,
Where did you get that?
It's so good. I love the shot where we see John Constantine leaving the building, and he's happy John Constantine wearing his sunglasses. And then there's a John Constantine from last episode, like watching him from the alcove. And then we pan over to see third John Constantine watching from behind the dumpster. And
I also enjoyed John Constantine catching the phone thrown by John Constantine.
yes. I think
kudos to Matt Ryan in this episode for not only playing multiple parts, but also, you know, there's a lot of times where you have actors who play the same version of the character and they're very distinct in the sense that, like, usually, you know, in this episode, for example, right, like the guy playing Gary has to play himself twice, but he plays him differently because one of them is a person pretending to be Gary. Whereas Constantine is playing essentially the same person just at different stages. And I think Matt Ryan does a really nice job of running the gamut here between, like, you know, Constantine who's blowing off his ex-lover to Constantine who has really... He's seen some stuff in the last 10 hours.
Yeah.
And, you know, he really does a nice job of both dramatic and comedic moments. And I think, you know, another reason that he's a solid addition to this year's crew.
Yeah. I mean, his, you know, that was me in the past, literally, and also kind of metaphorically speech, which also kind of doesn't matter because then he wipes his mind.
Right.
But, like, he has to say it for his piece, I guess. I thought was really great. It's also, like, I don't know, I'm kind of taken aback that it's, like, here is a story about, like, fixing a timeline that, like ripples through reality when two men kiss, and then, you know, everything is better. You know, that's not something, I guess, I expected to see in a mid-season finale for very many shows, so, yeah.
And yet it works here. Now, it is...
Yeah.
I also really enjoy that a lot of the actors got a chance to play several different versions of their character, because when you have Charlie pretending to be Sarah when she deals up with the commandos of chronology, and she's all, gather around, and she's trying to act like Sarah, and she's just so taken aback by them, and her body language is completely off, and I thought, oh, this must be so much fun, you know? give to Katie Box and say, okay, you're playing Charlie playing you, so think about the tics that you have.
Well, and Maisie Richardson Sellers again having to play Charlie pretending to be Amaya and doing a really nice job of like not quite nailing the American accent again.
Yes. Oh my gosh, I really loved the sirens of Spacetime as well, especially when they go in and they're all over Nate's dad. I'm blanking on his name,
but
he's evidently you know, he's the Charlie, you know, the Charlie's Angels. And I loved that they went in that direction with it. It was just so over the top and ridiculous.
I just love that they all got their like 80s style opening sequence where they're just punching guys in rubber masks. So
And the A-team references, too. Yeah, so good.
The Mick and Garima stuff really continues to crack me up, too. Because, you know, she's part of their Time Commandos thing. And you see them, like, making meaningful looks. Then he turns and mugs for the camera. And I was like, oh, my God, this is really funny. And then later he turns the fairy godmother into Captain Cold.
Oh. We've all been there.
I think that may have been perhaps the most surprising turn. And it's like 2 seconds. But that was not a thing that I could have predicted. So
no, she's in the parka and she's leveling the gun just like Wentworth Miller used to. And I thought this
And they're like stepping out of an armored car or something, right? That presumably they've just stolen.
Yes, it's so great.
We also get our explanation of why Zari is a cat. Because of course she was turned into a cat by the fairy godmother. And we have a particularly delightful scene where they turn her back into a human briefly. And then
look on her face and she's like, you dicks, pardon my language, but the way she says it is just so great. And she's like, this tongue has been places.
And then they have to turn her back into a cat because she's going to narc on them basically.
Then Mona wants to be turned into a cat.
And like, you know, Mona has really thought it out as to, if I had to be turned into a cat, what kind of cat would I be? Like, she's like, please make me calico and fluffy. And I was like, okay, in every reality, this is Mona. She is as immutable as Gary.
I feel like they've really leaned into what they are, and it's great. And I don't know. I mean, maybe it's just, I'm just so impressed by kind of novelty these days when so much TV feels very samey and, you know, Legends and Gotham are weird and unpredictable. And that's just a source of joy for me. And this was them at their most unpredictable. I thought it was great. So
the one lingering thing I have is, what happened to the back half of Ray's mustache? Because when we left off last week, part of the hilarity was that he was, you know, suspended in midair with half a mustache. And then when everyone comes to, you see that his lip is clean shaven and they've managed to subdue the puppet and get it tied all Hannibal Lecter style to a tiny hand truck. We also don't know what happened to Mona. But I will say, oh my God, this episode was just so reliably hilarious. And I love how it also wraps up the conflict between Rory and Ava, too, where he makes snickerdoodles from her recipe and offers them to her. And then it turns out she's been reading his book.
Oh, and she kind of compliments his writing.
What was that?
She kind of compliments his writing.
I know. Well, it turns out Nate's mom reads it too, because I think it was you who mentioned that. I went back and read it, and Mick is a published romance author. This is a thing that has happened, and I like that they both tried to bury the hatchet for Sarah's sake, and I think that speaks to a nice thing that gets wrapped up. That said, I hope it's not the last we've seen of Garima, and I hope that they come around and realize that this is a guy who. If the love of his life happens to be an entirely fictitious triple-breasted alien, who are they to judge? They've all been puppets and cats.
I suspect that she will disappear for a little while, but then this is the gun on the mantle place that has to come back.
This is this season's Bebo.
Yeah, that there will be in a place where it's like, we need an alien with a sword who happens to be Mick's fantasy. And so... break out the book, you know.
Oh my gosh, if she comes back with Bebo, that would be amazing.
Well, one of the things I particularly liked about this episode is that we lean very heavily on two characters who we haven't spent a lot of time with, who are Charlie mm-hmm. and Constantine. And that, you know, we basically, as we talked about a little bit last time, Zari has gotten elevated into the responsible one. And so they have mm-hmm. to drag her around, and she's the one who eventually talks them into thinking, like, you know, all right, you can't do this patchwork job, right, where you keep going back and trying to adjust certain things so that you end up with the right future and everything is perfect. Sooner or later, yeah. something's got to break. And that's, as we discussed, like a big reversal from Zari's character last season, who was kind of the rebel who was trying to break things. But she learned the hard way that you couldn't necessarily fix these things.
And here I go again, which was like last year's standout right. comic episode.
Yeah, so having the three of them together also felt very fresh, too, because it allowed mm-hmm. the characters that we know and have spent a lot of time with to be on the sidelines and do a whole bunch of wacky stuff as they kept going through all their different iterations, while anchoring us and giving us a chance to like stick with these characters who are learning about the process of being yeah. a legend, essentially.
Which yeah. is fun because they're the newest people in the Legends, right?
Yeah.
And they both have their kind of slightly different motivations for why mm-hmm. completely resetting the timeline is not what they want, because she loses her powers and he sends someone to hell. And so yeah. then they do these kind of ridiculous band-aids that are trying to patch the timeline with, you know, and that doesn't work, you know. I think back to yeah. the
well, cause they were pseudo the dream sequence in the in
yes.
Yes.
I think back to yeah, the sequence with I don't even remember who he is talking to. Barry is talking to a version of his father or another Flash, and he's got the like the cup that's been shattered, and you can kind of put it back together, but also it's still shattered, and so they're doing yeah. that. But it I feel like there's also a message here that like the, you know, I don't know, you could think of it as fragility or just amazing chance. The Legends as a team is the fact that they work is pretty ridiculous and is, I don't know, a great deal of luck was involved that all of these people fit together and have a moral compass and do things the right way, because one misstep and people are dead, or people have different moralities or different mm-hmm. agendas. And it seems like, yeah, they resort to shooting magical creatures dead pretty quickly if they mm-hmm. have not learned otherwise. So, yeah.
Well, it was nice because it made a case for Charlie, a more convincing case for her, where you figure out, okay, she's the one who gradually, I wouldn't say gradually, but she's the one who successfully plants and keeps in their head the idea that magical creatures' lives have value, that they're not, because what you see in both the Commandos and the Sirens is like, nah, it's just easier to kill them. You know, it's faster, it's more efficient, we don't do costumes anymore, off we go. And then she realizes, oh, it's because we didn't work together in London, and this is a really awkward way to phrase it, but she humanizes the magic people for them a little bit. And so I think that makes them much more open. And it was nice to make the case for her as Charlie rather than, oh, we like the actress and it's kind of fun that someone who looks like Natesex but is not Natesex is on the ship. And she's got an extremely self-interested reason for being there, because she was effectively handicapped by the equally self-involved John Constantine. And I liked that this time it was like, no, she brings an intrinsic value to the team because they get exposed to her. I also really enjoyed that the two arguably most selfish people on the team, or rather most self-interested people on the team, were the ones who were like, oh my God, we really broke time. We have to fix it. And it reminded me a whole lot of Zari's arc last year in Here I Go Again, where over the course of all the repeat things, you see that she gets to know these people so much better and she gets a vested interest in them. Mm-hmm. And that happened here too, obviously. Mm-hmm. What I've always wondered.
I appreciated also that they kind of address, why does Charlie keep taking Amaya's form once she has her shape-shifting powers back, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that is like, why do you need to look like that anymore? You were mm-hmm. trapped in that form. You're not anymore.
Right.
Yeah. Because yeah. that was, I mean, I think we talked about this earlier, you know, that the John constantly casually changing trapping a shapeshifter in a form that's not kind of their natural form mm-hmm. was, you know, not great. And so, I mean, I guess I appreciate that was a thing they come back to, is like, yeah, mm-hmm. that's not great. She's very unhappy with it. Yeah. And she will use that form for reasons.
Yeah, I mean, it's still, what he did is still a really fundamental violation of her sentient beinghood. I was going to say personhood, but she's a magical creature. I mean, it's still a really fundamental violation because he's like, oh, everything that makes you, you snip, gone. And then he's all, I lobotomized her. But as I think we've established, he's, as he says himself, he's a nasty piece of work.
Yeah.
And I think that you can't adequately demonstrate that until you can see him do things that other people have to live with the consequences of, while he just rolls on through, quipping and doing naked yoga in people's libraries and keeping a cigarette tucked behind his ear because of network standard practices.
Right. I mean, yeah, like, keep in mind at the same time, we have him, like, you know, he, I think this episode is also a path of realization for him. Two, that he mistreated her and that he, you know, there's a lot about John's regrets in this. But, like, obviously before Charlie showed up, Constantine was perfectly happy sending these creatures to hell, right? Like, yes. that was the first couple episodes. And that kind of seemed like that's the way this is going to go, right? We're just going to send all these people to hell before we decide to introduce Charlie and add sort of a moral question about it. And so I think what's interesting about this episode is that you force them to work together and put them in close proximity, thus making Constantine also have to reevaluate his choices in terms of, you know, he's already sent somebody he loved to hell. You know, he certainly needs to realize also that it's perhaps something that is too harsh a punishment for people who are essentially just trying to, you know, get out of a terrible prison.
Yeah. I mean, I read a lot of Hellblazer. I like John Constantine's stuff. I like John Constantine's stories. John Constantine is kind of a perpetually very broken person wandering around, leaving wreckage in his wake, and he's just kind of fueled by, like, guilt and nicotine and alcohol and like the literal ghosts of people that he has failed. And the choice to put him on a team-up show is interesting. I've never read into the comics where I believe there's a whole Justice League Dark where he's part of a magic Justice League that I have not read. But he's not a great team member because he's, I mean, yeah, I guess he's just selfish. I mean, part of it is just that he's very badly broken, right?
Yeah.
And we kind of, I guess, in this, we learn, because he sent his lover to hell, why he is broken in this instant. But it results in him doing some pretty awful behavior. And it's a little weird that he is kind of slotted into the, just by being a team member here, a hero. And he's kind of, his actions are more villainous even than Mick, right? Mick steals stuff. John Constantine will hurt people without a second thought, right?
I mean, there's a huge difference between, oh, he happened to sack Versailles on the way out, as opposed to, oh, he happened to send somebody to hell. And this reminds me, this show really does seem to be big on redemption arcs in general. I mean, we had the whole thing in season 3 with the Darks. And then it looks like we have kind of an ongoing thing this year with Ray's belief that Nora can be rehabilitated, and who knows what Nora's thinking at any given moment. But I wonder if this is kind of a thematic thing that the show is going to return to over and over again, which is that you can make a choice. You can make a series of choices to go from being a product of your circumstances and your bad decisions and choose to become something else, or it's up to you. You know, because they did that with Sarah Lance, too. You remember she was on, like, Arrow, I think, is like a feral, we threw her in the pit and she came back weird. That was like a plot line for her for a while, right?
That feels so long ago.
It was a long time ago.
And now she's basically like the mom of the Wave Rider.
Yeah, it is.
She's in a stable, happy relationship, and she's able to wrangle Mick and all of the other disparate personalities, and she's getting along with the bureaucracy. And so, like, we've had the redemption of Sarah Lance. We had the Dark storyline redemption where, you know, they were like, maybe I shouldn't have handed my daughter over to a demon. Is there a way to undo this? Where, yeah, there was, and he did.
I mean, I think that's a fundamental thread, as you're saying, running through Legends. I mean, even if you sort of go back to the first season that we don't talk about much, one of the ongoing things is about how, like, we're not heroes, you know, we're legends. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the you know, the motto. And it's true to a certain extent that a lot of the people who've come through the doors here have not been your typical heroes. And even some of the people who we thought might be heroes turned out not to be. Rip Hunter obviously has a very tarnished legacy, but also his last appearances were largely about his redemption as well. So I agree with you. I think there's a lot of, you know, redemption. And this show finds itself at its most interesting when it's investigating broken characters. You know, not to say there aren't people like, you know, Ray, who are kind of, you know, exactly who they say on the tin.
Yeah, not a lot of depth to the Adam.
Right, so.
this is actually kind of an ongoing thing for me. Is I wonder if they did this deliberately because they're like, we can only fix one broken toy at a time, or if Ray just kind of quietly inspires other people around him and we need to see value in that too, or what it is. Cause I was thinking this over and I was like, you're right. He really is just do, 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 do.
Well, and we addressed that a little bit in the London episode, right? Where he is, you know, forced to do things that are against his code. And that brings him up against Charlie and makes him, he is sort of, he's arguably the moral compass of the group. They don't always listen to him, right? But like, he is.
But he's always certainly pointing true north. Yeah,
yeah. He is certainly the most consistent, and I think that's a valuable. You need that to, like, you couldn't have the entire thing be chaos. But I think it does find itself more interesting when it investigates, as most drama does, characters who are deficient or broken in some way. Like even Nate, right, who is mostly pretty good. You know, he's dealing with his dad issues and trying to find a place to fit in. And his...
Yeah, those are going to come back to the fore.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I think it is, it makes for a really good ensemble cast, which is a hard thing to pull off.
Yeah, I mean, especially with this show, they've been through so many different variations of the ensemble. Right.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's why it's still working. And, you know, we talked about this too, but they're not afraid to swap people in and out. And I think that helps keep it fresh. So I think that helps a lot. And one of the things when they do the rehab tour on people, is I think it consistently promotes a point of view that, hey, people who make bad mistakes and people who are broken are still lovable and capable of good things, and you don't just throw them out. And that's a nice lesson to have, too. Or rather, that's a nice message to impart on TV week after week. The same way that it's nice to have Ray, who cheerfully insists that you should wash your clothes inside out because it helps preserve the color longer, and gets upset over the sugar in cereal.
he's such a Boy Scout. It's
It's so great. Oh, my gosh.
Which is funny, because I think it's another example of a character who I think has... You know, you could make the argument that he's devolved a little more into caricature since his
initial appearances. He's become a little bit more cartoony than the Arrow version.
But yes, absolutely. It's
okay, but I like the cartoony version, so I'm okay with it.
I agree with you. I think it's, you know, we talked a little bit about Sarah's development, right, into like the crew leader and everything. And, you know, it is fascinating to think, I was thinking back about this the other day, just as you were talking about, Lisa, like back to even season one of Legends, where Sarah was merely one among several people on the ship, right? And turning her into a leader and developing her character to being not only a reluctant leader, but a, you know, effective and confident leader is a really impressive and quite like quite a journey for to have gone through there.
Yeah, no, it's great. What I wonder is, I mean, Ray did see his fiance get killed in front of his eyes, and he did lose his girlfriend to the Arrow and all that. And at some point, we may see something where he's still working out the Anna issues and he doesn't realize they're there. But then again, on the other hand, maybe they have all just decided that just as Mick's thing is to be your unrepentant thief / romance novelist who has his own thing going on. Maybe they've decided that the thing for Ray is he's your cheerful moral compass who's basically the de facto dad of the group.
Right.
And until he gets hested by the darks and his love of Nora Dark or whatever. Yeah. But
Well, it's interesting because it makes me think of, you know, a lot of the earlier seasons of the show also dealt with conflicts between the characters. And that's not to say that doesn't still exist. Obviously we saw the whole thing with Constantine and Charlie this week. But I think they've developed sort of past the like infighting of the characters, which is a thing that always felt like it held the show back a little bit. And it reminds me of other shows where ensembles work really well because you have fundamentally a group of people who, even though they tease each other or, you know, sort of make jokes about the other person, they fundamentally love each other. I mean, that's what made
Brooklyn
things like
Nine-Nine.
Brooklyn Nine-Nine and Parks and Rec were going to be the two things I mentioned. But they're like fundamentally ensembles where you can tell that even though these characters have conflicts, they at the end of the day, they love each other. And like it's it's not going to change that aspect of it. And that is what Legends feels to me like now, is that you have these characters who really do consider themselves a family rather than just a bunch of people thrown together by happenstance.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't know if we had to have that arc, but I appreciate that it's like, they're still not always the most functional team because they're a bunch of wackos traveling through time, and they have weird personality quirks that are going to get in the way of doing progress, but I feel like they went to that well in season one a lot, where it's like, we're jerks and we're not going to do what's in the best interest of each other because we don't want to listen to anybody. I felt like they did that a lot. It got boring, I guess.
Agreed.
It did. Well, because plus you want someone to root for, and you can still root for dysfunctional or broken people. I mean, there are still plenty of shows. Like, look at Breaking Bad, for God's sakes. You had people rooting for all sorts of things on that show. But at the same time, you want to be able to identify on some level. And I feel like over the last season and a half, they've really gotten good about grounding these people in relatable conflicts. I mean, at the end of the day, Zari is very family-centric. She's, you know, because that was her whole jam. And it's nice to have somebody who does have that North Star. And then we've got Rey, who has some of the strongest internal values you're going to have. And, you know, by the way, I'm pretty sure he's going to... I love the callback to the songs, because that goes right back to the last season where they had all the jingles for all the different codes that they made everybody memorize. It was Rey and Nate who were like, oh, it's three. And and they, am I the only one who remembers that running joke?
Yeah, I do remember it, because they have, what is this one? Like a code blue or something? I forget. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it turns out that they've all memorized the songs because Rey has been singing the jingles around them. It's nice that they actually invested in making these characters lovable, because then I think the bigger themes are easier to slide in there, rather than if you start with themes or ideas and then just kind of shoehorn the characters in, which is what it felt a little bit like in season one, which, you know, for all that we don't talk about it, we sure talk about it a lot.
Well, I mean, when's the last time you saw a show have that bad a start and turn into something this successful?
This funny. Oh my gosh, it's insane. I can't get over the effort that must have gone into this episode, because they had three different credit sequences they did with three distinct visual styles. I find it incredibly interesting that you wipe out the women on the ship and you get a group of bro-y commandos who start decorating in the hides of their kills. And,
also, Ray's outfit when he's a custodian of chronology.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh. I found it hard to believe he went downhill that fast, but I love it, so I'm not going to say too much about it.
I mean,
he had a bingo card. He had the historical bingo card, which just killed me. I was like, oh, I'm really cleaning up on historical bingo. But I also
we all grieve it, in like, our own ways. Some of us were
and
bands,
also deeply hilarious. Yeah, the sirens of space time like went into Charlie's Angels mode that quickly. Like, I would have honestly have expected them to go in a much different direction.
Well, it reminded me a little bit actually of was it season? I'm trying to remember, season two or season three finale, Doomworld, which is the one where they the Legion of Doom uses the staff to rewrite history. And Sarah is one of the like enforcers. It kind of had that same sort of vibe going, where it's like, here's an alternate reality, don't think too hard about what would have actually caused this reality to happen, but like enjoy these sort of bizarre and twisted nature of what we're doing.
So Sarah is basically one reality twist away from wearing a leather cat suit at any point, is what we've learned here.
I don't think it's even a whole reality away necessarily.
Yeah, I mean, I think that stuff is in the closet. It's just like, you know, how many sweaters are in front of it? You know, you get trained by the League of Assassins and it just, you know, there's just an imprint. Yeah, there's an imprint of just like black leather on your heart that you can never get out. So,
These are my unwinding and relaxing clothes. The rest of you schmucks have sweatpants. I have this leather cat suit. Oh my gosh. So I think, other than us just sitting here and going, yes, this was hilarious, and reliably so, and I love that Nate's puppet has his little superhero costume.
Yeah, oh my god. I don't think seen since last year's crossover. I was thinking about that.
Yeah, well, we saw Zari put it on in Here I Go Again, and she also put on a little Hawk Girl costume too. That was kind of funny, but
worth noting too. You know, there is a a fun bit of meta humor to up front, where they say they've missed calls from Kara, Barry, yes, and Oliver. At which point they're like,
the yearly crossover.
The annual crossover. Hard pass.
And Nate mutters, Ollie owes me money. Yeah. It's just the petulance. I love it. It's I mean, I feel like the show these episodes did a great job in setting up the stakes for the back half of the season, even though they're deeply funny, because it explores the depths of Hayward Sr.'s perfidy, as it were, but it also raises the question of whether or not he's being manipulated by a demon.
Right.
You know, did the demon target him specifically because of the Legends of Tomorrow connection? Like, is this a game of three-dimensional chess, or is that just like a gift with purchase for him? So I really liked it for that reason. And again, the past 2 hours have been some of the most deeply stupid and hilarious and well thought out things I've seen on TV this year. And from the puppet serial killer to an angry Zari coughing up a hairball, which was just one of the best moments, where she's all bah, bah, bah. And they're looking at her, she's like, hairball, and she's so mad. I mean, I can't remember the actress's name off the top of my head right now, but she's just a really gifted comedian.
Yeah, I was trying to look that up too, because I've been very impressed with her this year. I thought especially she's done really nice. Tala Ash.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, she's done really great work. So let's see. If you had to be zapped into one of these realities permanently, which one would you go to, Tony?
Am I a puppet in the puppet reality? I guess I can
do
deal
you
with
want
that.
To be?
Yeah, I think I'm puppet reality. I know where Dan is.
All right.
What?
Dan, which reality would you prefer as your permanent reality?
I was actually going to ask if anybody was not going to pick the puppet reality, because that seems like the best.
I like you called it the Commandos of Chronology, which is a better name than they actually came up with, the Custodians of Chronology. But yeah. I totally believe that Nate and Ray came up with Custodians of Chronology.
Well, they need the alliteration, right? Like
they could have been Commandos of Chronology.
Commandos of Chronology.
Yeah, but yeah.
I'm pretty sure. They're like, no, we're cleaning up history. We're not harming. Yeah, there's probably that.
Lock and load.
I have to admit, I am super curious about what the world would look like if Gary had perished on the slopes of Vesuvius. But, I mean, that he never finds love. It's very sad. But yeah, mm-hmm. Puppet reality all the way.
Well, we don't have more legends until April, which is sad.
Yeah.
But the next episode, I think it may be luchador related, Dan.
Ooh. And a reminder to our podcast listeners, we do have a backlog of legends episodes from this season we haven't covered yet. And I feel like there's an opportunity to backfill in on some of the greatest hits from season 2 and season 3. I would love to discuss No Country for Old Dads, for example.
Excellent.
And I'm sure there are others. That is
a good, there's a lot of good stuff from last season. I mean, guest starring John Noble. Come on.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
All right. The show is amazing.
Oh, Gorilla Grodd and Barack Obama. And on that note, I'm going to wrap this up. This was the episode that discovered the mids. Discovered. No, we didn't discover. We discussed it. We discussed the mid-season finale, Legends of Two Meow Meow. I am Lisa Schmeiser, and with me were Tony Sindelar.
Meow Meow Nerds.
And Dan Morin.
I can't remember another line, so goodbye, everybody.
His tongue has been places. Good night.
Good night.